Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julie and Paul here live in the studio as usual. We'll be talking to our PG later in this hour. And our guest speaker this week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, is Phil Movett from the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society. Telling us all about what's in the sky, but in particular he's going to be talking about Comet Lemon. Oh, it's exciting stuff. Before I go any further, I'm going to say the Sheffield Photographic Society have got their Perspectives exhibition on this year. It's free. It's in Sheffield Winter Gardens. It started yesterday, Friday the 31st of October, and it runs until Sunday the 9th of November 2025, just in case you're listening on catch-up. That's next Sunday. If you're listening on catch-up, it is Saturday the 1st of November 2025. Can you believe that? Before we get on to the science news this week, there's a great article I saw in the press a while back, How Ripe Should Bananas Be When You Eat Them? Lots of fascinating facts in here, would you believe? The banana is a powerhouse, a terrific source of fiber, carbohydrates, potassium, vitamin B6, vitamin C and magnesium. But should you eat them green or wait until they're browning?
Some people black and really brown, don't they?
They do, but bananas actually have different benefits depending on where they are in their life cycle. So here we go, underripe. Good for gut health. Underripe bananas contain resistant starches, which act like a prebiotic by feeding beneficial gut bacteria. They're also lower in sugar than ripe bananas and may have a slightly lower glycemic index, which could help some people manage blood sugar better, although individual responses vary. But avoid underripe bananas if you have a sensitive stomach, as resistant starch can be harder to digest and may cause bloating or gas in some people. Potential cancer fighting properties. Well, in 2022, a 20-year study co-led by Newcastle and Leeds universities concluded that resistant starches, such as those found in underripe bananas, could reduce upper gastrointestinal cancers, including esophageal, gastric, biliary tract, pancreatic and duodenal, by more than a half. The dose used in the trial is equivalent to eating a daily banana. Before bananas become too ripe and soft, the starch resists breakdown and reaches the bowel, where it can change the type of bacteria that live there. And that, so says Professor John Mathers, who's a professor of human nutrition at Newcastle University. That very interesting one of underripe bananas. So what happens if they're perfectly ripe then? Well, the micronutrients found in bananas are their most potent when they've got that perfect yellow colour. Bananas are praised for their potassium, but they're an even better source of vitamin B6. A medium banana provides about 12% of your recommended daily intake of potassium, but nearly 30% of your daily vitamin B6 needs. And B6, if you're wondering, is key for converting food into energy and maintaining a healthy nervous system. There are also small amounts of vitamin C in perfectly ripe bananas. And when they're perfectly ripe, they're a perfect snack. The average 120-gram banana has about 100 calories, making it calorie-efficient and filling. And when bananas are perfectly ripe, they strike a balance between starch and sugar. So they provide quick energy and are easier to digest than greener ones. And if they're overripe, well, highest in sugar they are at that point, and best for sport, it says. Bananas that are a little past their prime, characterised by brown spots, have the highest sugar content. These are great if you're doing a pre-workout or you want something to eat mid-run, say. They're also much gentler on the sensitive stomach, which is good if you are doing a bit of exercise. The only downside is that they have a little less fibre because a lot of that resistant starch is converted into sugar. That high sugar level may also make them a poor choice for diabetics. I thought that was a fantastic article about bananas. Makes you think about them again.
Makes you think about buying some.
Yeah, well, maybe. Elsewhere in the science news, I'll shut up soon and let Paul do some talking. But men with suspected prostate cancer will be able to get a diagnosis from the NHS within a day under a new trial hailed as a potential game changer for identifying and treating the disease. Leeds Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust is currently trialling artificial intelligence or AI technology to interpret MRI scans and spot areas of abnormal tissue within minutes. Scans showing a high cancer risk will then be priority reviewed by a radiologist, and patients will be booked for a same day biopsy. That's a significant step. The AI software is called PI. PI has been developed by Lucida Medical and promoted for its speed and efficiency. And also, the article mentioned that 14 other NHS trusts are trialling the AI technology too, but they are not offering same day biopsies. So Leeds Teaching Hospitals are leading the way there. The announcement of these trials come ahead of the release of the government's National Cancer Plan, expected later this year. And prostate cancer is a big issue because there's not currently a standard screening process for that, for lots of reasons. It's a complicated issue.
And moving north, elsewhere in the news, Winfell Forest, a short drive from Penrith in Cumbria, is one of the few red squirrel sanctuaries left in Britain, and sightings are on the rise. This is due in part to the mast year that has produced a glut of seeds and nuts in the forest, but also thanks to the hard work of the crack conservation teams tasked with protecting the species. Meanwhile, first-time buyers are facing one of the toughest property markets in decades, and even if they are able to buy their first house, the chances are it will be in a so-called nature desert. Nature desert? Mm-hmm. According to the research by the Wildlife and Countryside Link, young people are increasingly moving to areas where there is lack of green space, which can have a detrimental effect on physical and mental health.
Indeed, yeah. We often talk about the importance of vitamin green. Get yourself outside, outdoors, particularly at this time of year as well. Finally, fossil fuel giants are understandably often first in the firing line when it comes to pointing the finger on greenhouse gases. But new analysis has found that major meat and dairy producers are similarly guilty. Research by a set of environmental advocacy groups shows that the world's 45 largest meat and dairy corporations were responsible for more than 1 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions in 2023. So think about maybe eating bananas instead.
It was hatred. Let it build up to every time you shampoo, it gets inside your head and tells you what to do. Conspiracy got me a little worried about being free, about being me. Conspiracy got me a little worried about being free, about being me. Maybe I should excuse myself from society and think of other people as pieces of me to do with what I please. Cause that would benefit me. As long as no one else is looking. Conspiracy got me a little worried about being free, about being me. Maybe I should excuse myself from society and think of other people as pieces of me.
A very interesting track there. That was Red Meat by Legless Trials. We're talking about major meat and dairy producers being guilty of a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. Great track, that. You're, of course, listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
On this 1st of November, can you believe that?
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it?
Time flies.
Should have realised with the fireworks going off last night.
Yeah, well, I think there'll be more to come as it falls on a Wednesday, doesn't it?
And what did we watch last night?
Halloween, the original. Ooh.
Ooh.
It was very good, actually. Way better than I remember it.
Yeah, were you still watching from behind the settee?
Well, no.
We had the back doors locked.
Yeah, locked. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, it's kind of a general thing, I guess. And it's about the questions that are still remaining for science. Because we keep hearing them about new discoveries and different things that have arrived. But also, there are things that you sort of come across and you think, well, yeah, it's straightforward, that. So a lot of questions still about formation ice and the different types of ice formations that come around. but as a part of looking at that, they were talking about ice skaters and how the ice actually allows them to skate along. So the reduction in friction is supposedly what does it. But the parallel to a thing I did some time ago about a simple question. You go to your kitchen drawer and you get a knife out and you cut something. How does it actually cut? And it's one of those things, well, it's straightforward, isn't it? You know, it's a sharp thing, so it cuts through. But how does it do that? And you sort of go, well, okay, the obvious things are it's the amount of pressure put on. So if you push hard enough, you can go through most things, but with a massive amount of pressure. But it doesn't completely answer the question of how does a knife cut. And in the same way, the premise about ice skaters is that ice, once it's formed, there's a surface film that's more liquid than the ice that forms upon the ice. And it's that slicker sort of form of water ice on the surface that allows the skate to be traversing across it with less friction. And it's kind of a thing that you come back to over time. Common sense seems to give us one answer, but if you push beyond what you think is common sense, then you find out that it's actually incomplete. So again, when we're looking at formation of rainwater, then we talk about the water cycle, and again, it's a subject that we've looked upon in the past. And the heat of the sun warms up the surface of water, it evaporates, and that ascends up into a collection called the clouds that we know about. And at a certain point, the temperature changes, and that water is released either as rain, as water, or as things like ice, sleet, snow. So you've got that cycle. But when you actually get down to the mechanics of it, it's still an incomplete answer. So science is sort of always getting by to a point of understanding. And there are simple things. I think the BBC, the website there, has a list of things, which is sort of thing, as you probably know if you've listened to the programme. I'm a cat owner, and the thing that cats are known for is for purring. But it's something difficult to actually see where those sounds come from. And quite a lot of the time, people are looking at cat behaviours and saying, well, they don't normally make the mewing sounds, but the hypothesis is that over time, they've copied the sounds of newborn human babies. So when they want to get you to feed them, guess what? They use the voice of a baby that's hungry. You sort of look at that. So the purring is sort of a difficult thing for them, because, again, it's not quite what it appears to be. But when they're purring, they actually are sort of looking at a different control of the cat's larynx, and it's that makes the sound, and it's actually constricting the larynx as it breathes in and out. And that's why it's come to this thing of its breathing regularity at a certain point also is the same kind of point where, in theory, it's very comfortable and very happy. So the purr is an adaptation over time, which really doesn't have a direct explanation. And again, in the same article on BBC, which you can go off and find, talking about glass. And I remember having some windows repaired that were old leaded light glass. And at that point, I'd read some sort of background information, and it's quite often people refer to glass as a liquid. What they used to say about window panes is that very old window panes thicken at the base and thin at the top. And that's because there's this kind of fluidity. But it's not exactly true. it's not actually a liquid. It's just it's known as an amorphous or non-crystalline solid. So that it's not a regular structure that you could truly call a liquid, but it actually is a slow movement over time, and when it's molten, it's in one form, but then you shape it into all sorts of things which cool down into a solid sort of state, and the molecules that move freely with a liquid slow down. So it's not quite actually living by the rules that we'd understand. And on a human level, we still wonder why we have a yawn. It's one of those things. We all do it, and we know quite often that you sit there on a bus and somebody will yawn, and people around them will copy that yawn for
yes,
some
I'm
reason.
Yes, I'm going to do that now.
So if you're being polite, then you cover it up so that people don't see it. But they're not entirely sure why we do it. It's the thought that potentially it could keep our temperature more regular at a steady level, and it could possibly be cooling the brain down. But that's still just a theory. Another thing is the thing of somebody else picking up on your yawn. So if you're tired, you think that that's fine, you yawn because you're tired. But the person who's observing you is not necessarily tired. They just seem to respond to your yawn and yawn themselves. So, wow.
Well, it's an interesting one, Paul, as sailors.
What's the answer?
Yawning is a sign of somebody being seasick.
Yes.
It's an early warning sign.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a trigger. So, yeah. I'd say that sort of strange things. And then a question that, again, is put on the BBC site is how a tomato came to have more genes than a human being. So if you put side by side a tomato and a human being, then we couldn't be sort of further apart in terms of looks, but it's something that happened genetically a while ago, and at the moment it takes around 7,000 more genes to make a tomato than it does for a human being.
What are you trying to say, Paul? Should we get some tomatoes on?
Well, the great thing they do there, say, is there's more genetic information in a bottle of ketchup than it took to create.
Wow, is that to do with gene editing or crop editing?
No, it's a quirk. In about 70 million years ago, the tomato that families belonged to somehow tripled the number of genes in its genome. So each gene had three copies, and then over time, the extra genes, which served no purpose, started to disappear. But it actually left the tomato with something that's got more genes, more genetic.
Isn't that interesting? Actually, it is interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing how these kind of what apparently look to be simple things in life. Say, science is forever searching for answers, and we're also trying to put some kind of numerical control or understand how things are happening. And I'll say it was a really interesting bit of diving into research about how does a knife blade cut, and it's kind of, well, is it the pressure? And at a molecular level, does it slice through atoms, which would be amazing? Or what happens? Does it push atoms to one side or other? So a simple thing, as you are doing, you know, cutting your toast into triangles in the morning, there's some questions that science still can't answer. In terms of what's going on.
Well, Paul's asking, can tomatoes yawn?
Well, that's the thing. I think we can yawn when we swallow a whole tomato, but
going back to the glass issue, there is a museum of glass in Sheffield University. It's accessible to the public. I forget what building it's in. We've been. It's somebody's collection, a professor. of glass. And I think it describes...
It's off Portobello, isn't it?
Portobello Street. Just Google it if anybody listening. But it's great. And it's a collection of glass from all around the world. But I'm pretty sure it says glass is a unique material because it's the only one that can have different forms in different states. So it's when it's hot, it's molten. When it's cold, it's solid. I think it can also be a gas. I can't quite remember, but it's amazing. And in there, his wife, this professor, that's his collection. I think he's dead now, but his wife's wedding dress, hat and shoes were all made out of glass polymer. A fascinating. It's called the Turner Museum of Glass.
It's just up.
It's Robert Hadfield side. Building. It's amazing. Well worth. Who knew that glass could be so interesting?
Yeah, just up the road from Western Park Museum. So, and that's another interesting sort of place where you can go and find out information from all sorts of areas. But I think it's that whole thing. And in terms of human beings, one of the unique things we are told from time to time is that we dream, and the thing is that they give a silly sort of example of a weird dream that you might have and say, well, what is actually happening? Why are we doing it? What do we need to do it? And we talk about sleep deprivation, so we seem to do that, and then we're told that actually sleep's a period for us to let our bodily functions regenerate, clean up, tidy up, and put our systems back in order. But dreaming's one of those things. So, you know, if you have a dream or you have a nightmare, quite often it's difficult, and films have gone down the route of saying, well, okay, look at this. This is terrible happening. Oh, no, I've woken up. And then, oh, no, actually, I haven't woken up. I'm dreaming that I've woken up, and this is going to happen. And you can go through this cycle of, well, you're dreaming something. Okay, what was that all about? And over the years, people have said they can interpret dreams on your behalf, and you'll find a lot of information that says, well, okay, typical dream is that you're falling through space, you don't know, you know, why you're falling. You wake up with a sudden start because you felt that you were drifting, falling, whistling down, you know, at a rate of knots. But what is it? What is the function? And they talked about it as neural repair, the brain sorting out any damage and rerouting information. But then you talk about dreams, so the continuation of that is memory. And in a lot of instances, we'll have memories. And you can say, well, okay, to get on in life, if you've got a good memory, that helps you to pass exams, and so you do well. But what would differentiate somebody who can do that to somebody who doesn't do that? And there isn't a potted answer, which is what science tries to achieve in a lot of these areas. So it's a lot of questions that get asked in science. Sometimes we get surprising answers, which we think is great, but quite often we'll get a hypothesis for an answer, which you tend to believe, but in actual fact, you don't get down to a point. And I think I've made the point about my headmaster at school. Was a preacher, lay preacher as well, and he stood in on one of our science lessons and talked about steam engines. So we said, oh yeah, okay, you've got a boiler, you put the water in, you apply the heat creates steam, and he sort of said, yeah, okay, and what happened next? and we said, well, it's, you know, the atoms are excited, and what happens next to make that happen? And his answer, at the point where you could no longer provide answers, was that that was where faith was.
And
quite often you find that with scientists, that they will come back to the point where you don't have an answer, and it is an act of faith. It's a leap of faith to sort of progress
until somebody else disproves it,
until somebody actually gets a proof out of some action. And it's how we progress, you know. I mean, good old Isaac Newton sat under his apple tree getting bonked on the head in the famous story with an apple, working out about gravity.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of that's gone on, but at a certain point, we tend to, human beings tend to give up and accept either, oh, well, it's inexplicable, or, oh, yeah, I'm happy with that level of explanation, and you don't look again. And quite often, scientists are the people who go, actually, I can't stand that, you know, I've still got questions.
Indeed. And you've and on that note, Paul, you've chosen a very interesting piece of music.
Yeah.
The Moody Blues.
1970, I think it is.
With a track called...
Yeah, question.
Brilliant. Great stuff, Paul. Thank as you, Paul. Always, we'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show.
Look forward to
bye
it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Why do we never get an answer when we're knocking at the door? With a thousand million questions about hate and death and war. Because when we stop and look around us, there is nothing that we need. In a world of persecution that is burning in. Tell me what will be. And when you stop and think about it, you won't believe it's true that all the love you've been giving has all been meant for you. I'm looking for someone to change my life. I'm looking.
Oh, very interesting track there. RPG's Choice Question by the Moody Blues, because we were talking about questions in science. And, of course, you are listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital. If you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. We should have Phil Muffett on the line. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, You're under the stairs again, are you?
I'm in my office.
Hello, you, Harry.
Does that mean you've been behaving badly?
No.
No, brilliant. Thanks for joining us, Phil. For people who don't know who you are, how could that be possible? You are a member of the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
Thank you very much.
Who does some sterling work. There's been some great stuff on your social media accounts from yourself as well as other people.
The club were... Ooh. Some nice photos on there.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of excitement in recent weeks. More excitement than you could ever have imagined, Phil.
Yeah, well, we never mentioned Comet Lemon last week, although it has been coming round the sky and everybody knew about it. The good comets that come round, it's either cloudy or they just don't actually come to fruition. But apparently this month, Comet Lemon has come to great... visual spectacular,
and this is a new comet.
Yes,
never been seen before. So where's it come from, and who found it?
They believe it's come from inside of the Oort cloud, not quite as far as where they can usually work out where these things come from, due to the orbit, and they can track back. So a guy spotted a German guy spotted it on the SOHO space satellite images. So anybody interested in the sun, there's a satellite called SOHO that's constantly filming the sun from space, so you can see what's happening. And you quite often see comets flying around the sun. Anyway, this guy had spotted it on the SOHO observatory site, reported it, and then obviously some other people seen it and then captured it. So there's different ways of capturing comets for the first time. Sometimes it's photographic, and sometimes people just spot them. Sometimes they just turn on until the sun's radiation eating the comets up, and then the gases fluoresce and light up the sky. So anyway, this guy spotted it, reported it, and he's confirmed it. And the thing is, they've gone back through some of the photographic history, and they actually picked it up earlier on in the year on like sky surveys, but nobody actually spotted it or recognised it.
Wow.
So it has been seen, nobody recognised it was a comet. So there's all these near-Earth object surveys going on, and it just goes to show they don't all get picked up. But it all depends how big they are, how bright they are, and, you know, if they're giving off a tail. So this just ignited, and it's been giving off a tail. So it's been quite long, and there's been some really, really good photographs on the internet for it.
Including yours, Phil?
Yes. So
the excitement.
I've spent a whole month. In fact, I've spent 3 months tracking this.
Wow.
On my star maps, and it started off as a morning object, and it's kind of moved through into late night, and then it's come through to the evening. Anyway, when it's been coming into the evening, it's been travelling through Bootes, and it's going through Serpens into Ephesus now.
What does that mean to us normal
the
people?
The constellations. So it's travelling across the sky from a west to an east direction, and it's near the celestial equator. So you can still see it after sunset, but it's getting lower in the sky, but the tail's pointing up. But it is naked eye. I can't see it naked eye from my back garden, but I did manage to pick it up last week with the camera, which I was amazed because my street lights were shocking.
Do you know, Rotherham Council's got a lot to answer for, no. Phil.
So
ruining you.
I've got some big sheets of cardboard, fastened them to bits of wood.
Oh, I bet family's happy about that, aren't they?
Robinson.
And the neighbours.
I've put them up at night time.
And take them down again.
And then take them down again. So I've got to, not only have I got to go through a procedure of putting my tripod out, setting my telescope up, and setting all my camera gear up, once I've done that, I've then got to like block out 2 or 3 street lights. So I've got these. We've had some parcels recently. I've saved the cardboard, made it into big sheets, fastened it to bits of wood, and then strapped them to fences and stuff so it blocks out the light.
Because otherwise
the light shines down your tube, and what happens is it reflects round your tube, and you pick up the street lighting in your image.
Yeah, which you don't want.
The street lighting out. So I've worked out it's not ideal. If they weren't there, it'd be much better. But I can block something like 80% of the light out, so I get darker images. Anyway, it's been working, and
you've got you've sent me some great pictures, and you've put them on social media. Now, you told me Comet Lemon is visibly green.
It is
due to.
Go on,
you tell me, because I've written it down.
Due to nitrogen and cyanogen and nitrogen and carbon in the actual molecules in the comet. So, because this is another thing, a lot of the short-period comets, long-period comets, have been flying around the sun lots of times. The sun gradually burns off all these gases.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because it's a new comet that's not been around the sun before, it's come into the solar system for the first time.
Wow.
It's all fresh. So it's giving off a lot more fluorescence and a lot more dust and a lot more ice.
And that's why people can see it.
It's a lot more visible. One of the other reasons is because some of the comet Swan, which is a relatively new comet as well, which is flying around the equator. So, it's on the ecliptic, which is the same as a planet. So it's flying around the sun in nearly the same orbit as the planets, which is harder to see because it's facing us and the tail's going away from us, so we can only see the head. So actually, it's quite a bright comet, but we can only see the front part of the comet. We can't see the tail because it's going away from us, whereas Lemon is going over the sun, so it's coming from underneath the sun. It's going over the sun, and then it's going to go back down into the southern hemisphere. So
wow.
The tail's pointing up, which is one of the really good reasons why we can see it so easily, because we're not only just seeing the comet's head, we're also seeing its tail going up into the sky.
And the trail is the dust and all the debris it leaves,
that's
is it?
That's all the dust, yes. Now, if a comet goes through our orbit, it will leave debris in our orbit that we will pass through, and that's how we get things like the Perseids, the Ursids, the Geminids. All these meteor showers we get are dust trails from comets that have been going around the sun. So it still stays in space and it's in orbit. So it's like seeding dust into space. Now, we'll not go through the tail of the comet, so we will not get a meteor shower according with this in relation to this comet.
In this one,
But basically, what I'm saying is that when all this stuff blows off into space, it's not just gas, it's also particles, dust, and anything else it's picked up as it's been travelling around space.
Wow. So what colour's Swan, the comet Swan, then? If comet Lemon is
more
green...
white. There is a touch of... I have picked up a touch of green in my photo, but the Lemon one's really, really prominent. It's really, really visible. The Swan one, because we're seeing from a different... I don't know if it's because we're seeing from a different attitude, but it's more fuzzy, and it's not as bright, but it's further away than what Comet Lemon is. So obviously, closer the comets are, the brighter it's going to be. The further away it's going to be dimmer.
Yeah.
So it's not just about that it's a fresh comet, it's all the fact that it's also quite close to us as well.
Wow. So what makes it the green colour then, this Comet Lemon? Is that the cyanide or the nitrogen?
Yes, it's a cyanide, it's a gas, yeah. It fluoresces in green.
Wow.
So, So it's how the ultraviolet radiation reacts with it.
So the comet, the one that's white then, this comet Swan, is whitish.
Yes.
What's causing that white?
Well, it's just reflecting dust and gas.
Right.
So most comets you see, they tend to be of a whitish colour. But you do get these that every now and again that are quite visibly green. So right. It doesn't look green to my naked, to the naked eye. When I looked in the binoculars, your eyes aren't as sensitive as film. So with the film, you can take photographs, use filters, and you can also adjust the colours on your phone or your computer when you get your images, and you can bring out these colours.
Wow.
So there are techniques you can do this.
It's amazing.
To be honest, on my photographs, I just remove the background light to bring out the colour.
The colour of it. And they're really good images. Now, going back to this guy, this German guy who first discovered it probably earlier this year, actually.
Yeah.
But does it get named after him then? The comets? Why is it Comet Lemon?
No, because there's also the sky survey. It's the Mount Lemon Observatory.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah, they do a sky survey, and they picked it up.
So they get to name it.
They've kind of named it. But yeah, sometimes amateur astronomers pick these things up and name it.
Because it's quite a thing to get something named after you. Could you imagine a Phil Muffet comet?
Yes.
You know, I just thought if you saw it first, you'd be able to say, ha ha, I want that. Yeah. I want to be named that comet.
The Lemon Comet was discovered by Mount Lemon Survey. It was a swan that was discovered by the...
The German guy. Did he get the swans? Is that named after him then?
No. I think that's also the survey group that confirmed
it. He just spotted it on one of their images and reported it. I'd be claiming it. I'd be going, wow, I've spotted it. Nobody else saw it.
Yeah. So it's quite interesting at the moment with the comets. I've had a look on the heavens above, and if you look on heavens above, there must be a dozen comets flying around at the moment. There's always a dozen or so, but they're not always visible. They're all down at magnitude 12, 13, 14 and 15, which is really faint, and you need really good skies to see these things and photograph them. I've photographed a Mag 10 comet, and it was really difficult to pick out on my imagery. You need really long exposures to pull these things out. But you do every now and again. One a year will probably crop up where it might be magnitude 6, 7 or 8. And then these are kind of visible with binoculars and your cameras.
So what magnitude would it have to be visible to the human eye then?
About 4 or 5. In my back garden, about 3.
So does it tell you on the Evans Above app then what magnitude it's likely to be?
It does, yeah.
So if you're a beginner and you think, do you know what, I want to try and look at... Yeah.
If you want to see something in naked eye, you want to be talking about magnitude 5 at least, or brighter.
Has the excitement been because they are new comets and therefore they're brighter or closer?
Yeah. Another thing, it's been something we've been able to photograph. I mean, it's lovely photographing things like Ring Nebula, Andromeda Galaxy. It's really, really good. But they're kind of static objects.
When you're photographing
asteroids, planets... Planets are easier to find. When you're photographing comets, they tend to be fuzzy, fainter, and they're moving extremely fast. If you look at some of the photographs people have been taking, if they've taken any length of time, the comet actually drifts across the image while they're being exposed. So you kind of get a bit of a smudge. Some people can track the comets, so the stars smudge and the comet stays focused.
Oh, clever.
So my photos are only 8 seconds long. So what I'm getting is still stars and a still comet because it's not moving in 8 seconds. If you're doing 10, 15, 20-minute exposures, the comet has actually moved visibly. So these things are really trapping around the sky. So we'll be able to see these for the next month.
Wow.
Perhaps a little bit longer. Next clear night, I'm going to be looking out for Swan because it's kind of due south from my house and it's a good aspect for me, whereas Lemon's now kind of down in the west after sunset and I've got trees and houses, so I'm struggling from my side.
So you've been lucky to capture it. I think you did it last week. Was that last week you captured it?
It was last week. Fortunately, the moon was new, so there was no moon affecting the sky, and I caught it as it was passing through Bootes. And it was near some bright stars, so I used the bright stars to find it, and then it just popped into
vision.
And I caught it between, I think it was about 8 o'clock, and it was in between the trees and next door neighbour's house.
Happy days.
I had about 20 minutes to get some photos.
But you did.
So it's made me.
Your year now because...
It's made me month,
earlier this year, you were right disappointed. Last time I think we spoke to you, said I've had months and months of seeing hardly anything. The weather's been rubbish.
It has been rubbish. I mean, I think I've only had my gear out 4 times this month. And I think last month it was only 3 or 4 times last month. So, I mean, some people observe for hours taking photographs. My setup's a quick setup.
Yeah.
So I'll be out an hour. I was out last week and I was out an hour, 2 hours perhaps. And my fingers were getting cold. And also dew was starting to form on my equipment.
Oh, you don't want that.
I've had a good session packing while I'm in front, because when you finish on a downer, it's not nice.
No, but who knew that all these things... So just all happened, didn't it? New moon, clear sky, da-da-da-da-da, right position for you.
I think we had a better... The other thing is the weather was nice on that evening. It was a bit breezy to start with, but even the wind died down, and I probably had a sweet spot for about an hour, and I just managed to catch it in between the trees and the houses. So, it happy days.
So, are you going to bet... Go on, sorry.
Yeah, then I turned to Swan, and I managed to get Swan because it's a better aspect, and it's above the trees. So I managed to nail that. I couldn't physically find it. What I had to do is I had to star hop, and then I had to take a couple of photographs where there was nothing other than stars, and then I dropped onto it. Then I guided my scope so it was centralised, and then I did a few exposures. So I was using stars to find what I needed to photograph because I just couldn't see it.
Yeah, amazing. So, you know, coming up then, as we go towards the end of the year then, are you going to better that, do you think? Is there anything else coming that you're
going to... I don't think so. Oh. Well, there's an asteroid called Eros that's interesting. It's been visited by satellite before, and that's in just going through Andromeda, so it's really high in the sky. It's only about 10 miles in diameter. Now, when you look at the asteroid Eros, it travels between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter and Earth and Mars. So it's quite elliptical, and to be honest, it could be an extinct comet that has ended up as an asteroid.
Wow.
So that's about magnitude 10. So I should be able to pick that up quite easily with my photographic gear, short exposure, and it's in a really good place in the sky, due south about, 10 or 11 o'clock. So if I get a nice evening in the next couple, this next month, I'm going to have a...
Have a go at doing that.
It's quite a small asteroid, but it is, because it's near opposition, it's quite close to us, so it should be quite, at the angular diameter of it, should be quite large. If it was out near Jupiter, it'd be too small for me to photograph, but because it's between Earth and Mars at the moment, I should be able to photograph it.
Amazing.
So that'll be a first one for me, another one. Also, I'm going to also try and photograph Neptune and also Uranus this next month.
Are they difficult because they're far away?
Because in the small, yeah. Yes. So the more stellar light, but with the camera.
Oh, you like a challenge, Phil, don't you?
So, well, you've been doing astronomy for so long, you've seen a lot of objects.
You want more and more, don't you?
Yeah. It's more of a challenge. Neptune's a challenge because it's very stellar light. And it's difficult to pick out, and I'm going to have to work out where it is. I didn't last month, and I didn't really particularly have any opportunities to photograph it. But Neptune is coming into a prime position for me, and then next month, Uranus, which is in Taurus near the Pleiades, that's coming round, and that'll be in a prime place. It's right up high in the sky in the ecliptic, and it should be a really good place to photograph it. And it just do observations, to be honest. So I might be able to have a go trying to photograph the moons. I got Saturn's moons last month. I overexposed it and picked the moons up, which were really good.
Wow.
So sometimes things happen and it's like, oh, I didn't expect to see that. So, yeah.
But that's what you get. So is there a lot of rivalry within your club then? Because you all be wanting to photographs and...
No, I won't say so. It's like me. It's like Mick Nichols, he's got his solar page. He's got some cracking photographs of the sun. I just won't bother because Mick's kind of got that.
Yeah, you've all got your own specialities, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right.
And you'll learn from each other.
A couple of people from, it's getting the best out of your gear. But the other thing is, people have got different equipment that suits different stuff.
Yeah, different.
So my setup isn't particularly for planets and the sun and the moon. Although I can see them and photograph them, it's not a particular setup for that. You need the like F ratio type of telescope. So my Quattro telescope, which is an 8-inch reflector, is no good for the moon really, because it's really fast and it's also really, really bright. I need eye magnification to like dim the moon down. Now it's okay looking at small craters and stuff, but really you're better off with a refractor, longer focal length. Whereas I've got mine more for looking at deep space objects like galaxies and nebula.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's, you know.
Right, before I'm going to have to let you go in a bit because the film's showing. But coming up to Christmas, Phil, then what are you wanting? What do you need? What do you need?
Yeah, I've primed my wife for Christmas.
Have so you?
After an Asia unit, which is like a computer hub, which you can plug everything into, including your camera. So I can leave my telescope outside and I can let it take photographs and it will beam the photographs back to my phone. That's the idea.
Oh, so you mean you can be inside?
Inside.
With a glass of beer or a glass of wine?
Yes.
I'm liking
much.
It.
Not too much.
Oh, no, but brilliant. I did wonder because, as with all hobbies, you always need something else, don't you? As you progress, you think, I could just do with that. Yeah.
Well, if you get into astronomy, there is tons of stuff. And the other thing is, there's such a big variety. So once you start, you can gradually build and build and build.
Yeah, it never stops, does it?
So don't buy it all at once.
No.
Buy the essentials and then expand.
Or better still, join your club and get to learn from the experts.
Yeah.
And maybe learn.
We've also got an observatory to be.
You have at Hoover Stand. I'm going to have to let you go, Phil. Fantastic chat, as always. Yeah. Thanks very much, and we'll speak to you soon.
Clear skies and.
Indeed. We're going to play out, listen, with the Lemon Song by Led Zeppelin, just for you and Comet Lemon.
Know that.
Yeah,
know that.
The Lemon Song. Here we go.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Baby, can't be satisfied.